morning, and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We were listening to Amazing Grace, Howard Wiley's Amazing Grace, and it's a part of his Angola project. And we are joined in the studio by Jasmine. Is it, how do you pronounce your last name, Jasmine?
It's Heiss.
Heiss, good morning. And Jasmine
good morning.
Is going to, good morning, thanks for joining us. And Jasmine is going to talk to us about Albert Woodfox and her work with Amnesty International. She is the senior campaigner with Amnesty International's USA Individual and Communities at Risk program. She advocates on behalf of the prisoners of conscience, human rights defenders, communities, and other individuals who are at the heart of Amnesty International's work. And she is the lead on Amnesty International USA's work on behalf of the Angola 3. So again, welcome to the show. I'm sure you're aware or you know Howard Wiley's The Angola Project. I'm sure you have that in your collection.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on your show this morning. It's really a pleasure to speak to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so tell us about your work and bring us up to speed on what's happening with Albert Woodfox, 42 years in solitary, and with his case overturned, what, 3 times now?
Yes. Well, I'm sure you know the case very well, but just for your listeners who may not be up to speed on our work on the Angola 3, on the Angola 3's place in the struggle against solitary confinement here in the United States, they're really one of the most emblematic cases of the long-term use of solitary confinement, this incredibly abusive practice that puts the United States far beyond the pale in the international arena, in holding people in cells really the size of parking spaces for decades. Albert Woodfox was one of 3 men who was placed in solitary confinement after a young white prison guard named Brent Miller was brutally and fatally stabbed at Louisiana State Penitentiary in 1972. As you know, at that point and now, Louisiana State is also referred to as Angola. So these men became known as the Angola 3. 2 of those men have now been released. Robert King, who was eventually convicted not of the murder of the prison guard but of killing another inmate, was released after 29 years in solitary confinement. Very recently, we lost the second member of the Angola 3 to be released, Herman Wallace. He died just 3 days after being released from solitary confinement of advanced liver cancer. And his case was really, you know, a sense of justice delayed having been denied for this man. And now Albert Woodfox is the only member of the Angola 3 who remains in solitary for nearly 42 years now, more than 4 decades. He's lived in this tiny space, and Amnesty International is calling for his release. As you've said, his conviction has been overturned 3 times, most recently on the basis of racial discrimination and the selection of a grand jury foreperson. That was in February 26, 2013. So he has been, in the eyes of the law, an unconvicted man for more than a year now. However, he remains behind bars because every time a court has ruled in his favor, the state has appealed. So what we've seen in this case is really the state's dogmatic and relentless pursuit of keeping this man in solitary confinement. And it's become clear that at this point, the Attorney General of Louisiana and those that work with them are not pursuing justice. They are trying to keep a man behind bars with a misplaced sense of vengeance. And so we're calling for them to withdraw their appeal to the most recent decision on Albert's behalf and to release him. We have a petition online at amnestyusa.org/Angola3 where we're asking people to go and call for Albert's release with us. And right now, tens of thousands of people have joined our call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does Albert have any more, is he going to be going to court again anytime soon?
So right now he is in a particularly acute state of legal limbo. As I mentioned before, in the eyes of the law, he's technically an unconvicted man. But because the state has appealed, it's gone before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we are all waiting for that court to decide. He's had his so-called day in court where his defense team went and argued against the Fifth Circuit once again, and now we're waiting. We're waiting for them to decide. In many ways, this is really Albert's last chance for freedom, and so the time to act is now. The moment is particularly acute, and we're asking people to join us in making sure that the state of Louisiana hears that this man can no longer be held in solitary confinement, not in the United States, not in the world, not in our names.
Oh, my. Wow. Yeah. So it's amazing how the state can continue to appeal this this decision over and over again. It seems that at some point their appeals should be exhausted.
You would think so, and this is particularly true in light of the fact that so many judicial irregularities have come to light during this process. In the same way that the Angola 3 case really shines a light on the cruelty and inhumanity of solitary confinement in the United States, this case has shown a light on the deep inequalities and the racial disparities in Louisiana's justice system. Things such as, you know, a bloody print found at the murder scene does not match Albert or Herman, and it was never compared with the other prisoners who had access to the dormitory on the day of Brent Miller's murder. Potentially exculpatory DNA evidence was mysteriously lost by prison officials. Multiple alibi witnesses who had nothing to gain testified that they were far away from the scene when the murder occurred, but that witness testimony didn't bear much weight in court. In contrast, several of the state witnesses lied under oath about rewards for their testimony, and many later retracted that testimony. To me, one of the most telling facts of this case is that the prosecution's star witness was eventually shown to have received bribes in exchange for his testimony, including things like a weekly carton of cigarettes, television, birthday cakes. And this man was a serial rapist serving life in prison. He was eventually given a pardon after testifying against Herman and Albert. And as I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners know, you know, the Angola 3, all three of those men have long maintained that they were innocent, and they believe that they were convicted and placed in solitary confinement because of their association with the Black Panther Party and because of their activism and outspoken critiques of injustice inside the prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And since these convictions, Brent Miller's widow has also, you know, come out quite publicly recently and testified to the innocence of these men and her husband.
Yes, Teenie Rogers is is an incredible woman. I think that the fact that she has come out of this after believing really for a very long time that Herman and Albert were guilty of her husband's murder, she's been able to look at the facts of the case, look at the transcripts, and say very clearly, I believe that these men are innocent. And because of that, you know, for those who are potentially not compelled by the fact that an injustice has been done to Albert and Herman, or who feel that that's important but also feel that, you know, some other justice has to be done for Teenie, it's important to remember that Teenie Rogers also feels that for four decades now she's lived without knowing who actually killed her husband, someone who she calls the love of her life. And so really, no matter what direction you approach this case from, you can just see it as a case clearly of injustice compounded on all sides, of people, of human beings treated as if they do not matter, as if their voices do not matter, and their inherent dignity being denied by the state.
So tell us about Amnesty International and your role in representing this particular case and others like this case. How long has Amnesty International been supportive of the Angola 3's release, and how long has Amnesty International sort of been focused around the plight of political prisoners and prisoners of war? Because in the United States, most people do not know that we have people that are political prisoners, you know, people that are in prison because of their political beliefs, which are contrary to those who are their captors, because Buddy Caldwell has actually gone on record saying that he would never, you know, release these men.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, and I think it's an incredibly important point. We've been working on behalf of the Angola 3 for many years. We also work on behalf of notorious people such as the Burge torture victims in Chicago, such as other men who have been placed in solitary confinement. We've issued reports. And as you mentioned, you know, many people do not know that these kinds of injustices happen here at home. Amnesty International USA's new executive director, Stephen Hawkins, has really pushed us in a new direction in recent years, really this year, as we talk about bringing human rights home. And as we work on increasingly domestic cases and ensuring that when we talk about universal human rights, we are acknowledging and recognizing that from, you know, the prison in Louisiana to the black sites run by the CIA where people are being tortured, there is torture, imprisonment, human rights abuses being committed in the names of American citizens. So largely, as we campaign against injustices on behalf of people like Albert Woodfox or Guantanamo prisoner Shocker Armour or Burge torture survivor in Chicago, Daryl Cannon, you know, we also need to educate people. We need to educate people about the international human rights framework and that civil rights, political rights are human rights. And so I think that for a long time we've been doing that work here in the United States in our work to abolish the death penalty, for example. And I think what's so important to remember is that the same racial disparities, inequalities based on sex, class, et cetera, that are present in the use of the death penalty pervade the entire criminal justice system often here in the United States.
How did you get involved in this work?
Well, I remember, actually, it's an interesting story. I remember first reading about the Angola 3's case specifically when I think I was 13 years old in Mother Jones magazine. So I came to Amnesty soon after graduating, and when I started working here, it was really, you know, I was working on it all countries on all issues as part of the Individuals and Communities at Risk campaign. What we do is look at the people who lie at the heart of all of these issues around the world, whether it's a community at risk of forced eviction in Haiti, for example, or whether it's a prisoner of conscience in Vietnam or a protester in Bahrain. But once we really had an opportunity to start work in earnest on the Angola 3 case, because this was a case that had been so close to my heart and really at the age of 13 opened my eyes to some of the atrocities in the criminal justice system and in the prison industrial complex in the United States, this is work that I pursued.
Wow, from 13.
From 13, yeah. Right, I feel incredibly fortunate to be at Amnesty today doing this work, absolutely, and to have met some of the really incredible people who are the reason that I knew about the case in the first place, people like Robert King, who since being released has become the most incredible and profound champion of the struggle against solitary confinement, and for Herman and Albert, people like Malik Rahim, Mwalimu Johnson in Louisiana. I mean, these are true heroes of the human rights movement in the United States.
Oh, wow. So you actually, you know, you've met and spoken to all three men. Is that correct?
I never met Herman, and I correspond with Albert. I write him letters often, but I've not had the chance to meet him. It's very difficult to go to the prison these days because his visitor list is short, and so many of the people who are on his list are people who can visit frequently. I live in Washington, D.C., so I can't get to Louisiana very frequently, and therefore it's not really fair for me to be on the list, but I, my letters with Albert, I mean, hearing directly from him, speaking to Robert, reading the things that Herman has written, these are testament to the power of the human spirit. Many people, you know, don't come out of solitary confinement without deep, deep wounds. It makes people more likely to reoffend. It drives people insane. And really, the clarion voices in this struggle that the Angola 3 have provided are incredible. They're examples of what humanity can endure and how those who have been treated worst can turn around and become champions of a movement.
Do you have something of Albert's that you could share the listeners so they could hear his voice?
I would have to dig through some of the papers on my desk, and I don't want to keep you all waiting. I mean, I think that one of Albert's most incredible quotes for me, one of the most incredible things that he said that I'm going to paraphrase since I don't have it in front of me, is talking about what solitary confinement feels like, right? He says something along the lines of, it's like standing on the edge of nothingness, staring into emptiness. And I think for me and for many of us who are in this work, that kind of sentiment, that sentence, so short, is what keeps us going, right? It's this human being who is in a cell and every day is surrounded by what could consume him, a darkness that could consume him, but he perseveres and he's still fighting and he refuses to be silenced. The symbol of Amnesty International, as I'm sure you know, is a candle wrapped in barbed wire, and it symbolizes shining hope in dark places. It symbolizes bringing a light to the darkness, and I think that in cases like Albert's, when that struggle every day for him is so real, that symbol for me becomes particularly poignant.
Yeah, that's quite vivid, standing, you know, nothingness. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit more about solitary confinement. I mentioned in an email that I sent you that there there was a special on Frontline about solitary confinement. It's a two-part series. And I don't know if our listeners were able to see it. However, Frontline World is they actually have a website, and you can watch programs afterwards. And I was wondering if you were able to see the beginning of the two-part series, and what you thought about it.
So I've spent quite some time on the website that Frontline has created, Locked Up in America, focusing on solitary confinement in the United States, and I think that it's incredibly powerful and incredibly important. I think that the fact that solitary confinement and really the pervasive use in the United States and the place that puts us in the world as an outlier, the fact that that's being discussed in an outlet like PBS on this Frontline program speaks to the growing groundswell of the movement against solitary confinement. I think it speaks to the way that people are approaching this issue that I think was once very difficult to parse, this idea that people were being held in cells. What did that mean? You know, is it really that important when there are also people being executed? People have really begin to dig in and understand in the United States that to hold a human being in a cage for decades is wrong, that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has said very clearly that after 15 days he considers it torture. In the case of Albert Woodfox, he specifically condemned it as torture. He has spoken out on behalf of prisoners such as Russell Maroon Schultz, who was recently transferred out of solitary confinement, right? This sort of international perspective, in addition to really the incredible domestic movements to combat the use of solitary, this speaks to the fact that people are beginning to wake up. They're beginning to realize that this cannot go on in their country any longer, that it's not being done in the name of justice, that it's not being done in the name of public safety, but that it is an atrocity that needs to stop here in the United States.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Russell Maroon Schultz, and also Hugo Pinnell. He was recently allowed his first contact visit in 40 years in February. He was able to have a visit with his mother.
And the idea, I mean, really the hope that this means that Hugo Pinnell can move toward being moved out of solitary confinement into general population, that is incredible. That's a huge step forward for all of us who are working to reform this process. And I think, you know, for a long time, Hugo was the only other person besides Albert and Herman who had endured that length of solitary confinement. We can only hope that the good news coming out of Pennsylvania, California, that will extend down to Louisiana. And this is a sign of change to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and people are aware, I'm sure, of the hunger strikes that were here in California, I guess, initiated by prisoners at Pelican Bay who have been languishing in secured housing units for decades upon decades. And just the whole idea that, you know, you have the secured housing units and then you have administrative segregation, which is the same thing, solitary confinement. And if you're put in at seg or the SHU for your own protection, you're also put in at seg if you're ill, like if you have mental illness or something, which compounds, you know, the illness. It's you know, just abominable.
Absolutely, and much of the work that we did around solitary confinement in California spoke specifically to the practice of putting mentally ill and youth into solitary. Absolutely, solitary confinement should never be used as a punitive dose. It should never be used on juveniles and the mentally ill, and it shouldn't exceed, in the eyes of the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, 15 days. And so the fact that all of these things are happening concurrently really speaks to how deeply broken the practice of solitary is, how deeply broken the systems are that are using it, and how much reform is needed. I always also think that it's so telling that at the same time that all of these men in California were striking because they had been placed in solitary for so long, there were simultaneously hunger strikes happening at Guantanamo Bay of prisoners there who are being force-fed, who are being mistreated. And I think that, again, you know, as we think about human rights here in the United States and what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the human rights framework provides us in terms of an understanding, it's that the injustices that happen in Louisiana, in California, in one place are deeply related to the injustices being perpetrated at Guantanamo Bay and at CIA black sites and other torture sites. You know, the fact that torture, that solitary confinement, that cruel and inhuman and degrading punishment has been accepted by such a large portion of the American population is something that is okay sometimes, speaks to this dramatic process of recalibration of our own moral compass and re-education that needs to happen here in our country. You know, one of my colleagues was saying to me the other night, no one would ever say that sometimes genocide is okay. So how have we come to this point where we say, you know, sometimes torture, sometimes solitary confinement, sometimes cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment is okay? And so as we work to reform the practice of solitary confinement here in the U.S., I think that, again, it's also about re-educating people, making people aware of what's happening, and making sure that there is really a global and national outcry of no more.
So why don't you give our audience information again on how they can join a campaign to free Albert, and give them the information again on how they can do that. And are there any successes that you might be able to share with us around this?
Well, you know, I think that is incredibly important, those moments to stop and celebrate successes. You know, for me, it's difficult to think about, but in many ways, the fact that Herman Wallace died a free man is an incredible success. Before he was released, we delivered more than 70,000 petitions to Governor Bobby Jindal from people around the world, but the majority here in the United States calling for his release. I think that, you know, despite the fact that Amnesty did not work directly on his case, the transfer of Russell Maroon Schoetz to general population from solitary confinement is a huge victory. As we see, you know, some reforms or at least conversation growing in the United States about the way that Guantanamo Bay prison is used, that is a huge victory. And so these things, you know, they don't happen overnight. It's a huge, huge struggle that we're fighting, and the victories are just milestones in the overall work towards justice. But those moments are important. It's important to stop and celebrate human lives that have been affected by the movement's work. again, if people want to get involved, the time to act is now, as I said, and they can go to amnestyusa.org/Angola3, A-N-G-O-L-A, and the number 3, and sign a petition calling for Albert Woodfox's release. You can also go to amnestyusa.org and look at the full range of our work. So if you're interested, an example, in getting involved on our global campaign against torture, which has cases both here in the United States and around the world, you can learn more about that in the fights across the United States to abolish the death penalty in many states. You can get involved in that work. There's a lot of work to be done, and we are always welcoming new people to our movement.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Jasmine, to talk about Albert Woodfox and his case, the only member of Angola 3 still behind bars, but certainly not the only man unjustly convicted and held behind bars. I didn't realize that this was, perhaps you said, his last chance, his last appeal.
Well, you know, he has a brilliant legal team, and I'm sure that they'll do what they can if the worst happens and the Fifth Circuit rules against him, but this is, you know, the last big opportunity for Albert, and so the moment now is incredibly critical. There's also a civil case that all three men have filed against the state of Louisiana, and we're waiting to hear about the dates for that. It will likely be this summer or later, but really, to see Albert come from behind bars to walk in freedom for the first time, the time to act is now. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how does the civil case differ from this particular, the federal case?
Well, the civil case is about the violations that have been committed against the men by keeping them in solitary confinement for this long. So it will not touch on whether or not they should be convicted or should be behind bars. It relates specifically to the practice of solitary confinement and to what Albert, Herman, and Robert endured at the hands of the state of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. So it could set a precedent?
It could. We certainly hope that it will set a precedent. You know, I think that as we look at other struggles for justice around the United States and around the world, holding perpetrators accountable is always incredibly important as you think about things like healing, as you think about things like reform. So that will be an important case, one that Amnesty will be deeply involved in and one we'll be watching very closely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And lastly, I was wondering, were there any cases of children being held in solitary confinement that you are representing, as well as women being held in solitary confinement that you are representing or that you know of?
Mm-hmm. So we aren't working directly on behalf of specific individuals in those cases, but we certainly are aware that those practices exist. And often we hear that in the case of children, you know, they're placed in solitary because the prison doesn't feel, or the jail doesn't feel, that there are adequate facilities for those young people, and so instead they're put in solitary. But the effects of solitary confinement on a young person are just incredibly damaging. They reduce grown men and women to insanity at some times. And so when young people who are really in the formative stages of their development are put in solitary, the effects can be catastrophic. So many of our suggestions when we issue reports specifically refer to the practice of putting youth in solitary, and it's something that should absolutely never happen. While we recognize that there are some points at which people need to be placed in solitary for very short periods of time, right? Children should never be placed in solitary. Similarly, although Amnesty has not really been deeply involved in the work on this, I've heard from other folks, other organizations who are very much engaged in this work that sometimes women who report sexual assault are placed in solitary. At the recent hearings by Durbin on the Hill here on solitary, Piper Kerman of Orange is the New Black fame spoke extensively about that problem. So, you know, again, I would encourage your listeners to do more research. And there are organizations always that touch on different parts of this issue. And so if that's the way they'd like to engage, you know, there's plenty of work to be done.
Yeah, and there was a recent hearing at the state capitol in California around health care of women who are convicted and prisoners here in California. We've had a real active California legislature around solitary confinement and health care for its prisoners. I don't know if it's that way throughout the country, but it's been really great to be able to engage the legislatures around issues like this. Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly important. So thank you to you and your California listeners for the ways that you're engaged in that work.
Yeah, I wish the same could be said about, you know, the Louisiana legislature and sort of conversations around solitary confinement, and specifically, you know, Albert Woodfox.
I agree. I think that there's a lot of work to do still in moving the needle in Louisiana in the right direction. But I'm heartened by the fact that there are really incredible people on the ground there, you know, who are helping to lead this work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for your wonderful work, Jasmine, and looking forward to celebrating with you and everyone else Albert Woodfox's release.
I look forward to celebrating it as well. I hope the next time we speak, we're speaking about his freedom.
That'll be great. All right, you take good care.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Wanda. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're going to play another piece from Howard Wiley's The Angola Project. We're going to play No More, My Lord.
Ooh.
That was the Howard Wiley, the Angola Project, No More My Lord. And I just wanted to pour a verbal libation for Cesar Chavez, who made his transition today, April 23rd in 1993, in St. Louis, Arizona. He was born March 31st, 1927, in Yuma, Arizona, and he was an American farm worker, labor leader, and civil rights activist who, with Dolores Huerta, co-founded the National Farm Workers Association. And a friend of mine, Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, sent me a poem to celebrate Cesar E. Chavez and the movement for farm workers' rights, justice, and peace. A eulogy that was written on the occasion of his death, Rafael Jesus Gonzalez. And it's entitled, At the End of April, to Cesar E. Chavez. At the end of April, the vines already green with buds, death came to the field worker, to the Cesar of the grapes, dressed in blue, of the onions in white petticoats, of the apples in red vestments. She said to him, Come, Cesar, and took him from the poisoned grapes, the watermelons, the melons full of ill, the battles of furrows, the ambushes of ditches, the Guadalupe standard, the red and black flag. But in the furrows, his voice left planted, his longing for justice, which is to say, his demands for bread for the hungry, healing for the sick, books for the innocent. His voice will bear fruit, and there will be rejoicing in the furrows, in the ditches, round the tables, in the land. And that's copyright Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, 2014. And he writes, Today, 21 years after, the promise and hope has not borne fruit. Farm workers are in even worse condition than when Cesar Chavez's struggle began. There is no union to speak of anymore, nor has there been for years, as Marshall Gantz, friend and associate of Chavez, has noted in a TheNation.com article. And Cesar Chavez, I knew. And so Rafael writes, We must learn from Cesar's action, success, and from his failures as well. The struggle for justice in the fields goes on. So I just wanted to let folks know that we lost a tree, one of the great trees in our forest of humanity, today, 21 years ago. So, with a few minutes left in, before our next guest joins us to talk about Vegetarian Week here in Alameda County and Oakland, California specifically, we're going to be talking to Christy Middleton, who is is Christy the founder? No. Yes, I think so. Christy is the founder of Meatless Mondays. And we're also going to be speaking to Crystal Smith, which is going to really be great. And she's a food policy coordinator for At the Humane Society of the United States. So they're going to both be joining us talking about the benefits of a vegetarian lifestyle choice and or life choice, I should say, and other things about eating for life and for health. So I'm still like trying to decide which. I just figured it out. I think I'm going to play a little bit of this Howard Thurman special with Liza Ronco and Dorsey Blake. This was recorded a while back on the occasion of the release of a wonderful Howard Thurman box set, which Reverend Liza, I think she edited it and sort of helped put together. And Reverend Dorsey Blake, he is pastor, senior pastor of the Church for the Fellowship of All People, which is the Howard Thurman Church in San Francisco. And this particular interview was recorded on November 8th, 2010, but it's always topical. So we're going to play a little bit of that, and if you're interested in hearing the rest of it, you should visit the website for Wanda's Picks, the radio show, and you can listen to it in its entirety.
It's hard to save them if they won't learn how to pray. If they won't learn how to pray, give them the blues and make them weep all day.
Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined today in the studio by, I believe, Liza Rankoff. Is that correct? Or is this
yes,
Joyce?
Yes, here. Hi.
Oh, okay, Liza, great. Thanks a lot for being so flexible this morning.
Sure.
And Liza is, let's see, are you... yes, you are the founding director of One Life Institute, a nonprofit organization based in Oakland. How was the Spirit and Silence retreat this past weekend?
It was wonderful, Wanda. You know, it was the way that the universe operates to have it the day after the Meserly mm-hmm. sentencing, and our retreat was held downtown at Preservation Park, which is not our usual space. But it was right on time and right in the right place, and we had more than 50 folks come out healing in community. It was a beautiful day.
Oh, that's really excellent. That's really excellent. And today you are going to be sharing a new project that is completed, the Living Wisdom of Howard Thurman, a visionary for our time, a new six CD audio collection from Sounds True, featuring the words and wisdom of a true spiritual visionary. And you've been a part of this project from its beginning over 2 years ago, and now it's complete. And so, I just wanted to know if you could tell us about this wonderful, wonderful project and about Howard Thurman. Dr. Blake is going to be joining us as well, and he is pastor at
mm-hmm.
Oh, there he is. Oh, just
all
speaking right. about you.
Right.
How are you, Dorothy?
Right on cue.
Right.
Hey, perfect timing. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we were just, I was just speaking about, this new project that's being unveiled, and you have a special program all lined up, I believe, Liza, at the Museum of the African Diaspora this weekend on mm-hmm. Saturday, November, what would that be, November?
The 13th from 2 to 4 p.m.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Well, let me finish reading your bio. Let's see. Besides being the founding director of One Life Institute, a nonprofit organization working at the intersection of spirituality and social action, you have been offered classes and workshops in spiritual development for over 20 years. And as a scholar, your main interest is exploring the powerful synergy between mysticism and change.
You maintain a special emphasis in the life and work of Dr. Howard Thurman, which we've been speaking about, teaching a variety of classes on Thurman in both seminary and community settings. And you are the you're the co-editor and producer of this audio collection that we're talking about presently. Liza, if you could tell our audience how you happen to have met Dorsey Blake, a man of like a lot of different hats. I remember when I first met him, I think you still do teach there, Dorsey, at the Graduate Theological Union at UC Berkeley, and you were working around sort of consciously diversifying the pool of seminarians of African descent there, and that was a long time ago. And then I see you at all these theater events, and then I've been to your church a few times, not as many times as I'd like to, because you know, you give out these great awards, and the last person to receive one of these wonderful humanitarian awards was Reverend Cecil Williams, and you gave one to Fania Davis, and you've given them to a lot of like people that I really admire a lot, and then you've actually produced plays at this church, and what I remember is that the church that you're pastor of is a church that was founded by Howard Thurman. And so anyway, I'm talking, and I asked you, Liza, to tell us how you met Dorsey.
That's all right, because in your sharing all of that, Wanda, you actually begin to tell the story of how I met Dorsey. When I was in my PhD program, my advisor said, you know, I was interested in Thurman, and I was designing independent learning, studying Thurman's works. And she says, you know, another one of my students connected with the pastor of Dr. Thurman's church, and you should look him up. His name is Dorsey Blake. And I think he's at the University of Creation Spirituality, downtown Oakland. I think you can find him there. This was a non-residential doctoral program, so she was in Jersey, and I was here, and I found Dr. Blake at this University of Creation Spirituality, and he very graciously agreed to meet with me. And from there, very graciously agreed to be on my doctoral committee, and thus began a relationship of a dozen or more years.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
So, yes. And I became involved at Fellowship Church during that time, and Dorsey has been a mentor for me in my study of Dr. Thurman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Dorsey, perhaps you could start and tell our audience about Howard Thurman and how you came to know him and pastor this church.
First of all, I would like to say that Dr. Ranker also is our webmaster at Fellowship Church. So when you go to our website, www.fellowshipfs.org, that work is the work of Dr. Ranker. And so many people have come to Fellowship Church because of that. So it's an excellent website that she's developed, and we're very, very grateful to her for that. And I am extraordinarily grateful for what she has done in terms of the release of these marvelous works of Howard Thurman. I've been teaching Dr. Thurman for, I can't remember how many years now, 20 years or so, and students always ask, how can we get his tapes? How can we hear him? Because the readings are fantastic in and of themselves, and yet there is something about Dr. Thurman's voice that really, really holds people and causes them to really center themselves. There's a way that he has of helping them to get beyond the traffic of the day and to really center themselves, their minds, their souls, and so on. And so the tapes themselves are just marvelous. Actually, there's a member of my church once who just said, if I could just hear some of his tapes, I'm okay. My introduction to Dr. Thurman was also in the academic setting. It was when I was a student at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. And was also a student at the Center for Urban Black Studies, which at that time was, in a sense, the Black Church component of the Graduate Theological Union. It came into being on Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th, 1969, and lasted for 24 years. The director there, Dr. Williams, Isaiah Williams, was a student of Dr. Thurman. He was at Boston University studying for his master's when Dr. King was there studying for his PhD and others. So he suggested one day that I should do an independent study on Dr. Howard Thurman. And I said, Dr. Who? And he said, Howard Thurman. He said, don't you know who Dr. Howard Thurman is? I said, no. Why should I know who Dr. Howard Thurman is? So, we actually had a telephone number for Dr. Thurman, and I called. I said, okay, let's do this. So I called and set up an appointment to get some of Dr. Thurman's books at the Howard Thurman Educational Trust, which was located at 2020 Stockton in San Francisco. And I went over and rang the three doorbells. I said, ring three doorbells, because the office was on one level, the living quarters on another level, second level, and then there's a room on the third level where he had some of the cassette tapes that Dr. Ranko and others had now put together. They had cassette tapes there where people could listen to them, and he would bring people from across the United States there, including people like Jesse Jackson for a spiritual refreshment and so on. So that's how I first met Dr. Thurman. He actually answered the door, and I didn't know who he was. And basically said, oh, I came to get some books from Dr. Thurman. And he said, yes. So I started walked right on past him, and there was a sense of presence that came over me. And I turned around and said, are you Dr. Thurman? And he said, yes. And so we began to talk, and it was a remarkable experience. He told me he was going to be preaching the next day at Fellowship Church. I went to hear him, and it was an extraordinary experience. My head was down, I think, throughout the whole service. And when the service was over, I went to greet him and to tell him how wonderful the service was, and he responded by saying, well, yes, I was wondering when you were going to come up for air, because he had seen me with my head down throughout the service. I say it because after that, I did the independent studies, and then a course was developed at the Center for Urban Black Studies on Dr. Thurman. And Jet Magazine actually said it was the first course, to their knowledge, that had been taught at the college level or seminary level on a black person. Those at the Center for Urban Black Studies.
Wow.
Which was shocking to me, because that meant there was not a course on Dr. King or anybody else. To jump forward, when I came back in 1977, one of the reasons I came back to Berkeley to work on my PhD, I was not sure I was going to come back. I was looking at various places, and then Dr. Williams told Dr. Thurman that I was coming back to the Bay Area to work on my PhD. And Dr. Thurman actually called me, then asked me if I would come and work with him at the Howard Thurman Educational Trust. Now, it was through that I really got to know Mrs. Thurman. So when I returned, after I left again, returned in 87, there was a conference at the church, Howard Thurman Scholars, and she invited me to that. And then later, when the church was having some real difficulties and so on, and the pastor was leaving, she asked me about coming to help the church decide which direction to go and so on. It was to be, I was a consultant with them, and the funny thing that happened, and Dr. Ranko knows this, so the new part of this was the fact that he asked me to be in the pulpit the first Sunday too, and could I do that? I said, yes, I could do that, Mrs. Sherman. And after that, she asked me if I could come the following week. I said, yes, but she always says, Sir Dorsey, could you be with us next Sunday? And she kept going on until I was there for the end of the year, and then I ended up being pastor there. That's how I got to Fellowship Church. It was through Mrs. Thurman's wanting me to be there to help give direction to the church. And I have to say my greatest joy was receiving Dr. Thurman's robe on my installation service in 1994. And it was presented by Mrs. Thurman and hadn't been worn since his death. It really sort of wiped me out. I was speechless and just ended up in tears. And most of the people in the church ended up in tears that day. It was so extraordinary.
And Wanda, Dr. Blake won't tell you, but he is the longest serving pastor in that pulpit. that he has he has served longer than even Dr. Thurman served in that pulpit.
Wow. Wow, that is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. So, so Liza, tell us about this wonderful collection of his work, six CDs. I mean, that's pretty substantive.
Yes, and, well...
Well, you're not going to be able to hear Reverend Liza Rancall talk about the box set that she put together that was released in 2010, but go to the website for the show, and you can listen to this broadcast. It was, again, broadcast first November 8th, 2010, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful conversation with Liza and Dr. Blake about Howard Thurman, a wonderful man. And we are joined in the studio by Crystal Smith. Good morning, Crystal. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Wanda?
I'm good. And Christy Middleton. Good morning, Christy. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for having us on.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so happy I could have you two wonderful women in the studio to talk about Oakland Vegetarian Week, which kicked off Monday the 21st and continues through Sunday, and you're just giving people an opportunity to try out, you know, meatless, healthy meals and seeing how, you know, you really don't need to eat things with eyes, right?
That's exactly right. We're really excited this week. It's Oakland Veg Week, but it's also part of U.S. Veg Week, so people across the country are taking a pledge to take a holiday for meat and try delicious plant-based options instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Christy, since you are the founder of Oakland Vegetarian Week, why don't you tell us a bit about this week, what people have missed. Oh, they're so sad. And what's coming up, which is a lot more than they missed, and how they can stay plugged in with your Meatless Mondays. And then I'll read your bios, and then we can talk more about sort of the importance of, you know, sort of monitoring one's nutrition.
Wonderful. Well, Oakland Veg Week was started in 2012 as a way to try to introduce the Oakland community to the benefits of eating more plant-based meals. Those benefits include our health, the health of the planet, and, of course, animals. And so we coordinated every single spring, and we encourage Oakland residents and people from outside of the area as well to take a pledge, and you can sign up for the pledge on oaklandveg.com. So folks who sign up will receive an email every day of Veg Week with information about how they can make some small changes that will make a big difference in their lives. We also get pledges from public officials, so we're joined this week by Mayor Gene Kwan, Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan, who is taking the pledge, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, State Senator Lonnie Hancock, Rob Bonta, and a number of the city council members and supervisors who are joining us all in taking the pledge. And the final component of it is events and restaurant specials. So we have events throughout the week. Last night we hosted Bryant Perry, who is a food activist, a chef, and author of four wonderful books. His most recent book is called Afro-Vegan, and it just came out on April 8th, so it's hot off the presses. And it's this incredibly beautiful book with recipes inspired by African-American cooking. So he was at Whole Foods with us last night where he did a book signing. Also, we were able to taste one recipe from the book, so we had a great time. We have events throughout the week, and all of them except for one are free, and they're a great way to learn more about how you can incorporate more plant-based meals into your diet, how you can surround yourself with others, because building community is so important as a way to keep true to our diet changes. So we encourage your listeners to join us for those events, and you can, again, learn more about those on oakwoodveg.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so since you're right on the air, why don't you tell us, you know, sort of what's going on tonight or this afternoon or this morning or all three, and, okay. and what's happening on Thursday, and you've got a few things, couple of things happening Thursday and Friday, and then you've got a field trip, I believe, on Saturday and Sunday. Saturday there are a whole lot of things happening because in the Bay Area, people are going to be doing their Earth Day work, cleaning up, various estuaries and, urban landscapes and things like that. But they can also take a field trip. And then on Sunday you have something planned. So tell us, just sort of run it down to us, give us the highlights.
Okay. Well, tonight we have Internet at Whole Foods Market in Oakland where we have a chef. Her name is Alex Burry, and she's a trained chef from the Culinary Institute of America. And she actually also works with us at the Humane Society. And she is doing a cooking demonstration show, very simple ways for folks who may not be as comfortable in the kitchen, tips and tricks to make meat-free eating very easy. And she's also going to be doing a tour of the store, so walking people around. And it may sound silly to some who may be more versed in the kitchen, but when you start cooking, sometimes you don't even know where to find these ingredients in the grocery store. So she's going to be walking around showing folks where you can find some of the new ingredients that they'll hopefully be incorporating into their diet. Tomorrow night we have another cooking class at Whole Foods Market with Chef Ruby Beaupre, and she's Whole Foods Market's healthy eating specialist. And she's going to be showing how you can make quick, easy snacks to keep full. We were talking last night, and she was discussing how keeping satiated is so important, and that if you're not prepared, that's when you make bad decisions about what to eat. There's this term that I only recently heard called hangry, where you get hungry, you get kind of grumpy, and then you make bad decisions. You just grab the closest food, which tends to be convenient food, packaged foods, maybe the things that are not best for us. So she's going to talk about the importance of staying full, having snacks that are healthy and very easy to prepare and bring along with you. Tomorrow night we also have a class. This one is not free, but it's definitely worth the money. It's at Brundo Ethiopian Spices. If you haven't been to Cafe Kaluchi, Ethiopian restaurant in Oakland, it's incredible. And they're doing a vegan cooking class, and I've been to some of their classes in the past. So if you're interested in exploring Ethiopian cooking, trying to learn how to make those spice blends, so you can do it at home, then it's definitely worth the money to go out and check out those classes. And we're also doing an event on Friday, which is kind of an optional on your own. We have restaurants throughout Oakland that are taking the opportunity to include new vegetarian options on their menus. So they're doing special. Some are offering prefix menus. Some are doing a discount for people who are coming in mentioning Oakland Veg Week, and others are offering some new special menu items through the week. And that's happening all week long, but we designated Friday as your night out on the town and encourage people to go out, support your local Oakland restaurants, and support Oakland Veg Week. And Juana, you mentioned the field trip. So there's a field trip on Saturday, which is the Animal Place Sanctuary. It's a beautiful sanctuary up in Grass Valley, California, where folks can go and spend time with farm animals. So most people have not spent a lot of time around farm animals, around pigs, around cows, chickens. These are animals that we often encounter three times a day on our plate, but we never have an opportunity to spend time with them, and we become so disconnected to animals who are raised for food, and we don't realize that they are sentient, thinking beings that are capable of the same emotions as our cats and dogs. So this presents a wonderful opportunity for people who are interested in going and spending some time getting to know farm animals, and that's happening up in Grass Valley. So there will be a bus leaving Oakland from the Lake Merritt BART station, but we do require advanced registration for that. Mm-hmm. Saturday we have another cooking class at Whole Foods, which is plant-based meal planning. A lot of people have the misconception that it can be more expensive to eat meat-free, and it can, but it also can be a lot cheaper if you're using whole grains, beans, rice, things like that. So you can attend that class on Saturday morning, which is free of charge, and learn some tips and tricks for making cheap and delicious meat-free meals. We're doing a social outing on Saturday evening. It's Veg Week Happy Hour, so people can come by Heinhold's First and Last Chance Saloon, grab a drink, get a delicious no-no burger, and meet other people who are taking the Veg Pledge. There's another cooking class at Brindo on Saturday, and Sunday we have our wrap-up event, which is a celebration at the Lake Merritt Sailboat House with Colleen Patrick Boudreau, who is another Oakland author, and she's also an empowering speaker who is the author of 6 books and will be delivering a talk on the topic of food ethics, animal protection, compassion, and also how we can continue moving forward and hopefully embracing Veg Week and aspects of meat-free eating throughout the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. So we've had an exciting week, and we hope that your listeners will join us for some of those events.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that sounds really awesome. And yeah, so there's a National Vegetarian Week that's happening sort of simultaneously that Oakland is plugged into. That's really awesome. And I was just thinking also about there is a talk as a part of the Martin Luther King Jr. Series of talks that are hosted by Congresswoman Barbara Lee and the Honorable Elihu Harris around healthcare and the new Obamacare and sort of what that means. I believe that's on Thursday as well. So it's sort of real great synergy around food and health happening sort of simultaneously. I'm going to read your bios now. Christy Middleton is the food policy manager for the Humane Society of the United States and the founder of Oakland Veg. She has successfully worked with dozens of corporations, hospitals, and other institutions to improve the plight of farm animals through humane-minded purchasing programs and has worked with some of the nation's largest school districts, including Los Angeles Unified School District, Detroit Public Schools, and Broward County Schools to implement Meatless Monday. Her work has been covered by national media, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and CNN. Where is Broward County School District? Where is that at?
That's in South Florida, so it's just north of Miami.
Oh, you really made the circuit. Goodness gracious.
Indeed, yes. We try to be everywhere because this is an issue that affects people all over the country, and so we're excited to have the opportunity to work with schools from coast to coast and everywhere in between.
Right, yeah. And Crystal Smith, thank you so much for joining us, Crystal. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here.
Good. You're the policy food coordinator at the Humane Society of the United States. You work closely with food and nutrition professionals across the nation to implement Meatless Monday and other healthy, sustainable, and humane eating initiatives. You specialize in sustainable food solutions, particularly the environmental impact of modern agricultural practices and food systems. You hold a Juris Doctorate and a Master's of Environmental Law and Policy from Vermont Law School. And so it's perfect, you know, that you're joining us, Crystal, to talk about, both of you actually, you know, working in policy, but Crystal, to talk about, I was thinking about water and how it's becoming a real scarce commodity and it's non-renewable here in California and elsewhere in the country. And you look at sort of the ozone sort of impact on our weather and how it's, I don't know how it is, you know, where you are in Washington. Are you in Washington?
I am. Yep, I'm on the East
Coast.
Yeah.
But,
we get a lot.
Yeah, it's just really, really crazy. And also, I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the policy and the environmental impact of, you know, of the positive impact of, you know, having a vegetarian or food-based lifestyle. And also I was wondering, I want us to also talk about food security and food deserts and obesity. So there are a few things I'd like for us to touch on. You don't have to do them all at once. But first, why don't you talk about sort of, sort of the impact on policy that, you know, sort of looking at other ways to feed, you know, our nation has, you know, in a positive light.
Sure, sure. So, as you mentioned, I just got out of law school, and I did a lot of studying, looking at our current environmental policies, I'm really trying to figure out exactly where, you know, where we as individuals can help. And all my studies just came back to one simple fact, Wanda, that when we're looking at the way that we're currently raising our animals for food, it's just so resource intensive. It takes so much more land, as you mentioned, water, oil, and other limited natural resources to produce the meat that we eat than it does to produce plant-based, delicious foods. You know, they're just going to be in much more abundance. So, you know, even though there are, when it comes to environmental laws, there are some environmental laws that are put in place, but demand for meat, because we just eat, you know, we eat far too much meat in this country. We can't keep up with it, and it requires us to operate these factory farms, which aren't good for animals, you know, aren't good for the environment, and certainly will have some negative impacts on our health. It just becomes unsustainable. And so one of the best things we can do, of course, is just to try to lower that demand, you know, try to reduce our meat consumption. And that's why, you know, what you guys are doing in Oakland and then what we're doing on the national level with U.S. Veg Week is so good, because it's really highlighting, you know, not only how easy it is, you know, how delicious the food is, and, you know, giving you practical skills and tips to actually implement it, but it just, you know, in the long run, it's just going to make you feel better, and it's just something simple that we can do 3 times a day to really help some of our worst problems, you know, health problems, environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, Christy, I'll let you make a comment as well. I was wondering, though, if you could tell us, Crystal, what does it mean to be the food policy coordinator at the Humane Society of the United States? What is the Humane Society? Both of you all are involved in this particular organization. You know, Christy, you're the food policy manager. What does it mean to be the food policy coordinator, and Christy, the food policy manager?
Well, I work with Christy in food policy, and what we do is we go around, as she mentioned, we go around the country talking to major institutions, so K-12 schools, hospitals, and universities, anyone that's really, you know, serving a lot of meals, and we educate them. You know, we talk to them, things, you know, encourage them to increase their current meat-free options. We promote the Meatless Monday program, which is one initiative that's very easy to do and actually has a lot of benefits. Even, you know, just one day a week cutting out meat can do a lot. So we're working with these institutions to really try to reduce the meat consumption. And the Humane Society, you know, we focus on all animals, but we particularly look at farm animals. And we do that by focusing on what we call the 3 R's. So that's reducing or replacing our consumption of animal products, and then refining our diets by choosing products from sources that adhere to higher animal welfare standards. So it's a lot of different things that we do, but for the most part, we're really out there encouraging people to really start reducing their meat consumption and giving them tangible tips and processes and resources to help them do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Christy?
I think Crystal did a wonderful job summarizing it, but to give you a little bit of background on the Humane Society of the United States, it's a national animal protection organization. In fact, it's the nation's largest, and we work on issues affecting all animals, from wildlife to cats and dogs to marine mammals. And what a lot of people don't recognize is that farm animals, those who we raise for food, like the dogs and cats who we welcome into our families, into our homes, who we consider our family members or individuals who have distinct personalities with needs, preferences, and most importantly, the capacity to suffer. And so we seek, as the Humane Society, to have a better world for all animals, and that includes those who we raise for food. And we're trying to do that through programs that help people reduce the number of animals they eat, or source products like your milk, your eggs, your meat from farmers who adhere to better standards for those animals. And as Crystal mentioned, we work with institutions on implementing programs like Meatless Monday, which is a simple program that involves doing exactly what the name suggests, going meat-free one day a week, and it has the support of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and dozens of other public health institutions, as well as environmental organizations and animal protection organizations that are trying to get us all on board with taking a holiday for meat just one day a week to make a tremendous difference.
Mm-hmm. So how did both of you, were you raised, you know, eating vegetarian? Is that a part of your, you know, sort of the lifestyle that you have been familiar with for a very long time, or did you decide to eat this way as adults? How did you come to this particular type of choice, you know, plant-based foods?
Well, I can start with that. One, I can tell you, I was very much an adult when I started this. I grew up in Houston, Texas, so I did eat a lot of meat. You know, as many Americans do, it's so meat centric. But because I was concerned not only with animals but with the environment, you know, after just doing a little bit of research, I really realized that being vegetarian is something that I could really personally do. That's not only going to help the animals but the environment. And I come personally from a history of disease in my family. You know, lots of my family members suffer from high blood pressure. There's heart disease and stroke and history of cancer. And all of these things, you know, study after study, it's being published right now that's completely showing that, you know, reducing our meat consumption or adopting vegetarian and vegan lifestyles is one way that we can really reduce our risk for these, you know, leading causes of death, heart disease, diabetes, cancer. And it's, you know, it has had a wonderful impact on my own personal health. I can certainly tell you I've been vegetarian for over 5 years now, and I do not look back. I can't tell you how much more varied my diet is, you know, how excited I get. There's still new foods that I'm finding out about. You know, just a couple weeks ago, I got reintroduced to Brussels sprouts. And there's so many different things you can do with it. So I'm so glad to have made the change. And only wish, you know, that's why I love my job so much, because I'm able to talk to other people in K-12 schools particularly about, you know, the many benefits of eating a plant-based diet. And I wish I had was privy to this information when I was younger, but it's never too late.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
Like Crystal, I was raised eating meat. I grew up in Virginia. My dad hunted. We ate a lot of meat when I was growing up. But I also lived with a lot of animals. I always had pet dogs. I had birds and fish and all kinds of animals. So I grew up with a really strong love for animals. And that affected me later in college when I learned about how animals are factory farms. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with that term, factory farming, it really is what the way that most animals are raised in the United States for food these days. They come from not the small family farms that we envision when we think about where meat comes from, but rather they're coming from these massive warehouse-like facilities. There are these devices called gestation crates and battery cages, and gestation crates are cages that are used to confine mother pigs. They're confined in these cages that are about the size of their bodies, 2 feet wide by 7 feet long. The mother pigs are confined in them during the entire pregnancy, which is about 4 months long. They can't even take more than a step forward or backward, and they can't turn around for the duration of their pregnancy. They're put into another crate to give birth, and then they're put back into the gestation crate. And this repeats itself over and over again for about 4 years, so about the amount of time of a typical presidential time of a presidential term. So just imagine living in a crate so small that you can't even turn around. It's really one of the most egregious acts of cruelty to these very intelligent, sentient animals. So learning about things like that is what made me move away from eating meat into a meat-free vegetarian diet and then later plant-based or vegan diet. But there are so many other reasons now that I get excited about it, like Crystal, learning about the health benefits. While I did it for ethical reasons, now I'm a lot more conscientious about what I eat and certainly recognize that eating a plant-based diet can help prevent and even reverse chronic disease, and also can help us be more environmentally sustainable. It's also something that is really easy when we're looking at ways that we can make a difference in the world. Sometimes it seems very daunting, but if we can sit down and enjoy something that's delicious and we can involve our families and our communities, and it really is exciting, to be able to explore a whole other way of eating and recognize that it's not just that we're eating, we're also helping solve some of the world's biggest problems when we move away from supporting industrial animal agribusiness and instead eat delicious meat-free meals.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were both speaking about sort of the, you know, the choice that you made to eliminate you know, meat from your lives, and you know, the positive impact that has had on your health and also, you know, well-being, and your commitment to sharing this this particular choice with others. I was just thinking about, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that, you know, in many, many communities, you know, here in the San Francisco Bay Area as well as other places in the United States, there are, you know, what's called food deserts, which means that access to fresh food is very limited, and there's a lot of hunger in America, particularly among the young people, like children and families that don't have food. And then, you know, so people eat the school lunches, which are, you know, high sugar and high fat. And I don't know if people who are listening are aware that we spend such a small amount of money on you know, health, childhood health with regards to the school lunches. And the same corporation that has most of the contracts for the public schools throughout the country also has the contracts for the military as well as for the prisons. So, you know, we've got a whole lot of populations that are don't have much choice around nutrition. And I know, you know, with regards to your food policy, I'm sure you all are looking at that. I mean, it would be so great if all of the public schools throughout our country had you know, more healthy options for the children. But also if you could speak to the food deserts and how that impacts, you know, a person who might want to have a vegetarian choice but they can't find any vegetables.
Right. That's an excellent point, and it's an issue that I'm very passionate about, and I'm really excited. I used to live in West Oakland, and we had a few local community gardens that were sprouting up in the neighborhood, and I'm very excited, you know, to support groceries like People's Grocery and Fat Beet Farms, where they're trying to bring access to fresh produce at an affordable cost for people in these food deserts. I've also worked extensively with Oakland Unified School District and the school, and not just because I love Oakland so much, but I will really say that this school is a pioneer, not just in California, but across the nation in terms of the work that they're doing to try to provide healthier, more sustainable food for kids that the kids will actually eat and enjoy. They've done Meatless Monday there, so every Monday at the elementary level, the students are eating an entirely meat-free meal. They also do California Thursday, so they're trying to source all of the food that's on their Thursday menu but from sources in California. And this week, they're also participating in Oakland Veg Week, so they did a Meatless Monday menu on Monday. And throughout the week, they have primarily vegetarian options on their menu. And the school district also challenged all of its staff and students to take the Veg Pledge. So we've met a few people who have come to our events throughout the week who are there because they learned about it from Oakland Unified School District. So the school district is doing tremendous work to try to bring better, healthy food to students, especially folks who are in low-income areas and food desert areas. They actually even have farmers markets, so people, parents can come and purchase fresh produce at the farmers markets at school sites throughout the city after school, and they've even done some cooking demonstrations because that can be problematic too, where people want to eat healthier. They go and buy the produce or they buy the legumes and they don't know how to prepare it. So this is a great way for folks to not only purchase the food, but also learn a little bit about how to prepare it.
And just to quickly add to that, some of the ways that we're addressing some of the food desert issues here on the East Coast are by encouraging them to actually have community gardens. And that's just a wonderful, you know, way not only to get a whole lot more fruits and vegetables in the community. But as Christy mentioned, you know, it's an educational thing. We've got children growing this food, so they're more connected to the food. It is, you know, it's fresher. So it's, you know, even though it's a problem, there's a lot of different solutions that are actually being implemented across the country. And I think, you know, by focusing on these plant-based foods, it's wonderful. And we're definitely being able to see the positive results of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Crystal, since you're in Washington, I'm sure you have the ear of a lot of legislatures there. And I saw a film, and I'm sure you're aware of it. It came out a while back, maybe 2-3 years now, Christy Jacobson and Lori Silverbush, co-directors of A Place at the Table. And it's a wonderful document that just looks at just the policy issues around you know, access to nutrition and how that's so limited to the poor here in this nation. And President Obama and, you know, his wife, the First Lady, have done a whole lot. She has done a whole lot specifically around nutrition and access to different food choices. But legislatively, there's no money going into any of this. So I was wondering, what are you working on now that we can support you on?
Well, right now we aren't I'm not directly working on any legislation where we're looking at addressing those issues particularly. We do a lot of legislation. It's more tied directly to farm animals. But it's certainly something that we support and something that we speak to when we're going around to these different places talking to them about these issues. And I think at the core of some of this is, you know, again, we've got this really this focus on, you know, getting a lot of meat. So even where, you know, we do have these food deserts or, you know, this low access to nutrition, people are still so tied to the meat so that they're going, you know, they're spending a lot of money disproportionately on focusing on meat products, which, you know, even at that level, because it's not the leanest cuts, you know, it certainly isn't the best food at all. And there's just not enough education then on getting the things that are more readily available and really focusing on making a full meal out of the beans, you know, that we grew up on, black-eyed peas, you know, pinto beans, kidney beans, you know, chickpeas, that are a little bit more readily available and more affordable. And as Christy mentioned, you know, going through and just focusing on educating people about how, you know, not only how much better these are for you, but how to prepare them, you know, how to spice it up, and because there's so much that can be done with it. So I think that's really more of where we're focusing right now, but definitely, you know, working with the different initiatives. We have a lot in common with the Let's Move, with Michelle Obama's campaign, and there's so many, you know, similarities to our efforts that we just continue to press on. And I think we are, as Christy mentioned, we're beginning to see some progress, you know, slowly but surely. But I think one of the first things is really talking to the people. The more people we can get, you know, signed up for these veg pledges and educated about this, it's just really going to increase the tenor when we go to the legislators about actually getting some of these more hard-hitting policies put in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Christy, do you have any comments?
I think Crystal summed it up very well, but really, again, at the core of it is that as a society, we really have focused a whole lot on protein. People are protein obsessed, and they don't realize that we can get protein from all kinds of plant foods, and actually in a very pure form that doesn't go along with cholesterol and saturated fat. So, you know, a key part of something that we like to work a lot with, on, is helping demonstrate how easily these foods can be prepared and how inexpensively they can be prepared. Beans and rice is something that's been eaten for, you know, for centuries. If you look at all types of cultures, that's really what is at the heart of our cuisines, is some kind of grain and some kind of bean or legume. So we really need to try to get back to those kinds of foods, which can be very inexpensive, and, you know, very filling, and certainly full of nutrients that will help us be very strong and healthy as a society. And, you know, we certainly are supportive of efforts to try to embrace policies that will give better access to healthy food and also try to move away from policies that are giving subsidies to farmers that, you know, are raising animals for food so that we can make meat cheap, which is why so many people are eating it three times a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly true, you know, that people are eating it because it's easy. You know, a lot of communities, all they have in the neighborhood are fast food places and the corner
mm-hmm.
store. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't done a shelf check recently at 7-Eleven looking to see, like, what are the choices for, like, do they have beans and rice at 7-Eleven or
mm-hmm.
do they have beans and rice at Stop and Go? Because a lot of communities,
mm-hmm.
That is the store. And one
mm-hmm.
woman mentions a place at the table that, you know, she has to travel, like take like two buses to get to the store and two buses to get home to be able to find a store that has fresh vegetables. And there's no land around to be able to grow food and you don't need land necessarily. If you had enough space, you could have, you know, some of those pallets to be able to grow, you know, some lettuce and whatever. And I was just thinking about, you know, people who are, you know, sort of living, you know, from paycheck to paycheck or on public assistance that don't have, I mean, in California, you know, we have great weather, we have some land, and, you know, and you know, there are schools that have gardens, and which is so wonderful, you know, that they have, you know, they're growing the food and then they're eating it at lunchtime. I mean, that's not something that happens throughout the country. And then I'm thinking about people that are, you know, in some form of custody. I'm thinking about the children that are in the juvenile prisons in San Leandro, you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, our other vast amount of people that are incarcerated here in California. I don't know what it's like on the East Coast in D.C., but we incarcerate a whole lot of people, and if you are a vegetarian in prison, I visit women who are incarcerated, and one woman told me that she hadn't, she said like onions, fresh onions were a vegetable. Like they don't see like vegetables. I mean, like cauliflower or broccoli or lettuce. She said onions. I'm like, onions? Onions?
Yeah.
So, you know, people might want to be vegetarian, but access is just really limited. And I was wondering how far, you know, the Oakland Veg Week or the National Vegetarian Week sort of, where does it go into these places where you might not think, oh, somebody might want to have a vegetarian option, but there are no vegetables?
Yeah, that's an wonderful question. It is something that is such an important topic for us living in communities where there are food deserts and where a big proportion of our population is living without access to fruits and vegetables. We spoke last week. We had a representative speaking at the West Oakland Neighbors meeting to talk about Veg Week. But in terms of, you know, doing events and hosting events there, we haven't, and it's something that we're interested in doing more of. We've worked throughout the rest of the year. Oakland Veg is an organization. We've hosted Chef Robert Dorsey, who has an organization that teaches young chefs, especially from inner city schools or more impoverished areas of the Oakland community. He's going and teaching young kids how to cook and showing them how it's exciting, and also especially trying to help young men see cooking as something that can be macho and helping them learn that this is a potential for a career path. So we've supported him going and doing these cooking demonstrations and sponsoring him going out to Oakland events. Last summer, you may recall that the city of Oakland was hosting events on Friday night in certain neighborhoods where there is high rates of crime. Try to give something, give kids and families something to do. On Friday nights, they were hosting events, and we sponsored Robert Dorsey to go and do cooking demonstrations so that he could show local families how they could prepare these foods and do it for cheap and you know, prepare foods that their families would enjoy that were entirely plant-based. So we are keeping those communities in mind, but we also are very cognizant of the fact that there are a lot of struggles there. And, you know, recently I was thinking about how difficult it must be for families, as you talked about, to have to take two buses to get to the grocery store and do it with a few kids in tow. That's got to be very difficult. So, you know, the things that we suggest are making moderate changes, and people may not be able to go 100% vegetarian, but every step that you can take in that direction, if it's a meatless Monday, or you go vegan before 6, or you try to eat meat free on the weekend, all of those things are a step in the right direction, and hopefully we'll soon have more answers to the issue of food deserts as all of us in the community work to try to make some progress in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was eating raw for a bit, and I'm vegan and gluten-free and sugar-free and dairy-free. So my daughter, she's getting married on Saturday, and she says on Sunday they're going to have a brunch. And she mentioned the restaurant. I was like, I don't think I can eat anything there. She said, oh, that's okay, Mommy. I want you to come. You know, you're used to being hungry. and I just wondered if you could speak to that. I'm really happy that, you know, you have a list of restaurants that are offering vegetarian options. But I go a step further, quite a few steps further, and in my eating choices, and a lot of times I can't eat anything, and because a lot of things are pre-prepared, they can't take things out of the recipe because it's already shaked up and baked or fried or whatever. Yeah, so if you could speak to and I am hungry a lot, so I usually just, you know, make sure I eat before I go out to eat, just in case.
Well, you know, living in Oakland, we have access to some of the best restaurants. We have a list of restaurants that are participating in Oakland Veg Week on the website, so again, offering specials for the week, perhaps offering a discount. But other than that, you know, pretty much any Chinese, Indian, Ethiopian, Thai, Middle Eastern restaurant you go to, you can find some kind of vegetarian or vegan option. And even if they don't have it on the menu, they're usually pretty quick to make an option for you. Moving further along the spectrum to raw food, that might be a little more difficult. But again, being in the Bay Area, we are home to a number of wonderful restaurants like Cafe Gratitude that cater to people who want to eat more raw foods. But in general, restaurants can be tricky for people in other parts of the country. But Crystal and I travel extensively, and I love to eat as well. And honestly, I have had a pretty easy time of finding people, and I have an ongoing joke. Like, my favorite restaurant on the go is Ruby Tuesday, and we don't have a lot of those here in California. But it's a, you know, kind of family restaurant. But they have a great salad bar. And for folks who travel a lot, it can be difficult to stay healthy when you're traveling. So I like to just go and fill up there on a baked potato and salad bar. But that's not what we want people to think, that vegetarians and vegans have to live on all the time. There are so many wonderful international cuisines out there where you can almost always find a vegetarian and vegan option.
Crystal, why don't you tell us some of your favorite restaurants in your neck of the woods where people can eat?
She's right. So we are fortunate to have a lot of vegetarian and vegan restaurants here. But as Christy mentioned, there's so many other restaurants. One thing, one of my favorite restaurants to go to is any type of hibachi style restaurant. I do like a lot of Asian foods. And there's always going to be tofu on the menu, so there's not even just one. Pretty much any of them will have a tofu or very nice, well-seasoned mixed veggie dish that's not only healthy, you know, but it's really, really good. Also, Thai food is also my favorite. We have a couple of, single Thai foods around here. That's the Thai food restaurants that are just absolutely great and Ethiopian. But just to touch back on what Christy was saying, I mean, it's I knew, you know, I've been vegetarian now for over 5 years, and it's just going by leaps and bounds. I mean, we travel a lot, and every airport that I go to, there's always something that I can find that's already packaged, that's even labeled vegan or vegetarian, and that they also have the same flexibility. If you can always ask them to leave something off or add something else, and they're happy to do it. So it's quite easy, and again, it's just so many options out there. All you have to do is ask. It's a lot of goodies out here, and lots of food trucks. I don't know if you guys are food trucks, but the food trucks are out here as well that are just really, really good to go out and explore.
Right. It sounds like it's an attitude shift, isn't it?
No, it is. It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And, you know, I failed to mention this earlier, but a new study just came out about 2 weeks ago that I think it's really going to be good, for the African-American community. It's focused. It was a health study. It was published in the Journal of Public Health Nutrition, and it was a really, really detailed study. It was 26,000 black advocates. They were part of the Loma Linda University Advocates Health Study, and many, Seventh-day Adventists are, adopt a vegetarian lifestyle. So they had a 26,000 participant study, and it concluded that these black vegetarians were at less risk for hypertension, diabetes, high blood pressure, and total cholesterol. And as I mentioned before, this is something I already knew because, most of my family they are still meat eaters. So they, they struggle with cholesterol, high blood pressure, and that's just something I haven't had to deal with, since I've been vegetarian, and we talk about it all the time. So it's contrary to popular belief, people believe that these are diseases that are really going to be something you have to, get a lot of medicine to treat or, undergo a lot of different surgeries. But, more and more people are coming out with these studies saying that really the best thing we can do is just increase our servings of plant-based foods. And as Christy mentioned, there's so many things out there, salads, different, not just iceberg lettuce and dressing, but all sorts of things. It's a wonderful time to be involved in this. And I really encourage people to pledge and try it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Crystal, for mentioning the study. That's a lot of people, 26,000.
Yeah, 26,000.
And we think about, sort of environmental illnesses, and food is medicine. And and you can change your life and change your health and change, you don't want to expect to get this disease or expect to get that disease if you live to be this age. And you certainly, no matter, even if it's in your family, history, these particular illnesses, a lot of it's connected to diet. I mean, definitely,
yep.
Diet
mm-hmm.
and exercise and how we think, even in the worst situations, how we sort of process information and how we spin situations, even when they're bad, is how we think about them, can definitely have a positive impact on our health and longevity. So, it's proven. I mean, here's another study, but definitely, changing your diet can lengthen and change the quality of one's life, because you could already have a disease and really shift its impact on your life if you change your diet and food, plant-based foods, that's the way to go. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think. I can't think of many studies around the benefits of meat, on health.
Yeah, right. I mean, there are so many with these large sample sizes. There's another one, 375,000 adults. Came up with the same conclusion. Meat is directly tied to obesity, and we have to reduce our meat consumption. And the beautiful part about it, Wanda, is that, you're not having to do anything terrible. All you have to do is start eating more nutritious and delicious meals. These are absolutely wonderful, amazing dishes. So it's not, anything that's bad. It's just a paradigm shift, and that's what we're trying to do, just educate people. Let them know how easy it is and the different options they have. And, for the vast majority of people that do it, they can think about the results and they stick to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And people also need to sort of, you know, as they're shifting and, you know, looking at rethinking their dietary choices, to eliminate sugar as well, because sugar is such a poison. And, you know, as they shift to, you know, plant-based, you know, food, you know, to think about limiting and eventually eliminating sugar, because sugar is a real killer, you know, particularly high fructose corn sweetener. And sugar is in everything. And then you look at salt.
There's no high fructose corn syrup in kale and spinach and quinoa and brown rice. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
just naturally delicious and nutritious.
Oh, you're making me hungry. Oh, my goodness. So what does it entail, making the pledge? You know, you mentioned that a couple of times, both of you. What does it entail? How does a person do that? And what are you pledging to?
Well, there's an Oakland Veg Week pledge at oaklandveg.com, and you can take the pledge to try Meatless Monday every Monday of the year, or you can try to eat vegetarian for the rest of the week or vegan. It's all up to you. But there's a lot of evidence that if we put our commitments in writing or we tell it to the world, that we're going to stick with that pledge. So the idea is to try to embrace eating meat-free for the week of Oakland Veg Week and U.S. Veg Week. You know, as Crystal talked about, this is something that we've got ample scientific evidence to support, that eating meat-free is better for our health. It's supported by the American Heart Association, the American Institute for Cancer Research has said that we that the evidence is very clear. We all need to eat less meat and more plants. The World Health Organization supports this, and countless other scientific journals have said that we need to eat less meat, we need to eat more vegetables. So that's what pledging to try Meatless Monday or Kicking the Veg Pledge is all about, embracing eating more plant-based foods.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. And why don't you give the website again for the pledge, and is it a different website for you, Crystal, or is it the same for the National Vegetarian Week? Are the Oakland Veg Week and National Vegetarian Week, are they connected via the website?
There are two different websites. I'm sorry, Crystal. Go ahead.
So I was just going to give the National Veg Week is usvegweek.com. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
Okay. And Christy, is there a specific one for Oakland?
There is. It's oaklandveg.com.
Okay. And you mentioned already that that you have the Meatless Monday. So this is sort of a national initiative, but after that, let's say, for instance, April 28th, we're back to Meatless Mondays, right?
Right. Well, we hope that people will keep on embracing meat-free eating for the rest of the year. And I mentioned before that we have a number of public officials who are supporting the Veg Pledge. Last year, Congresswoman Barbara Lee took the Veg meat-free for a week, and she, last I heard, was still, you know, participating months later. So, you know, the idea with this is to just try it for a week and see how easy it is. And a lot of people will continue eating meat-free, if not every single day, incorporating it more into your lifestyle throughout the rest of the year. But as you mentioned, beyond the Veg Pledge and Veg Week, there is Meatless Monday, which is the international campaign that was founded most recently by Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, but was initially started during World War I as a resource conservation campaign. And millions of Americans are going meat-free on Monday. Everywhere you look, there are websites and recipes that are promoting Meatless Monday from the world's biggest food companies like Walmart and Nestle, even Burger King, the king of burgers, has a veggie burger that on Monday it plugs using the Meatless Monday Twitter hashtag. So it's a movement that has legs, and it's definitely gaining a lot of momentum. Oprah Winfrey is doing Meatless Monday at home, so lots of people are supporting it, from everyday Americans to some of our biggest thought leaders.
Yeah, I was just thinking about community, and a lot of times, you know, you mentioned that making the pledge, you know, then you say it out loud and you have witnesses. So what I'm thinking is that, okay, people have, you know, sort of come into the whole idea of, you know, based food sources, and they do this for 7 days, and then where is the community after that? So I'm just wondering sort of how do people stay plugged in to be able to talk to people about, you know, sort of their food choices and share recipes and not feel isolated or alone, because maybe they might be the only one at work, you know, trying, you know, plant-based food choices, and they might want to, you know, have some kind of camaraderie. So I was wondering where does that go after this week is over? And that's why I was wondering about the plugging into, you know, the Monday at least, and there might be something around that. But just wondering sort of how do you keep people sort of supported around this after this week?
That's an excellent question. You're absolutely right. Our community really does help us stay on track with our healthy eating habits, or, you know, if you eat with friends who are eating cheeseburgers and french fries, then we're very likely to eat that way too. So having a community is so important in terms of keeping and sticking to our healthy eating pledges and any other healthy efforts that we're trying to make. So throughout the rest of the year, folks who take the Veg Pledge can opt to receive a weekly Meatless Monday recipe. So those we send out every Monday throughout the year, a new recipe idea. And we will continue organizing events throughout the year because I work full-time. It's not always easy to have events and do a fair amount of traveling, but we do want to create community. And that's what Oakland Veg Week is all about, is trying to bring together community so that hopefully people will meet others who are interested in healthy eating, who are interested in trying to eat more environmentally friendly foods. And we hope that we'll be able to keep the momentum going throughout the rest of the year. In Oakland, we have East Bay Vegan Drinks. So usually once a month, we'll have a happy hour drink social, or some people just go for the camaraderie to meet others who are interested in eating more animal-friendly and healthy foods. And I know that they do that on the East Coast as well. Crystal, you know, you may want to talk a little bit about some of the community events that happen there to keep folks on track.
Sure, and I can start by saying that on the usvegweek.com, even after Veg Week, there are going to be resources on that site to help you motivated, to give you additional tips. Lots of it deals with sending out recipes weekly, a Meatless Monday recipe, and other recipes throughout the week. Another good resource, though, is to, if you do feel alone, there's other online resources for communities. There are meetup groups. Some of them are very broad, just vegetarians. Some of them are even Black vegetarians, or, you know, environmentalists, or whatnot. There's a wealth of resources on the internet that you can gain some more community, and definitely resources on the usvegweek.com page to keep people motivated. So it certainly doesn't end on, you know, April 27th. it's something, you know, I started 5 years ago that, you know, it's just become ingrained, and I think it has a lot to do with the many different resources that are out there to keep you motivated. And if you are the only one in your office, it's a great way to get other people involved, you know, just sharing your delicious meals, you know, once a week or every other week, you know, letting people try some of what you're eating, letting them see the wonderful foods that you're eating. So it's a lot easier than it sounds. And one other thing I want to add about community, you know, when I was looking into this, you know, as a young African-American woman, I felt that there wasn't a lot of people that looked like me doing this, but that's just not true either. There's, you know, Coretta Scott King, people I've looked up to, they're vegetarian. You know, I love Erica Badu. She's from Texas as well. She looks amazing. You know, she's vegan. You know, there's Russell Simmons, Common, Carl Lewis, Prince, Tia Mowry. You know, people, Cory Booker, you know, young and old. There's a lot of different people that are vegetarian or vegan, that, you know, look great, feel great, and that we look up to. So it's not anything anyone should feel lonely about or discouraged. There's definitely a community out there.
And I was also wondering, with regards to, you know, the events happening nationally and locally for those of us here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where are you all going to be showing up Which one of these events are you going to show up at, Christy, or have you made them all? But you can't make them all if they're, I guess you can't make them all unless you can clone yourself if you have three in one day. And Crystal, where are you showing up? Yeah, people want to actually, you know, sort of put a face to the voice and to the planning and to the policy work.
Well, this is Christy speaking, and I'm going to be at all of the events that are happening at Whole Foods. I won't be on the field trip, but I will be at basically every other one of them. So I hope that your listeners will stop by and say hello, and I'm sure that you know, that those will be great places to meet others in the community and hopefully create some relationships that will last and help keep them on track with their meat-free eating goals.
And I am actually on my way. I'm in New Jersey right now. Tonight I will be speaking at a screening of Vegucated, another powerful resource about vegetarian eating that's, you know, online. And I'll be there at 7 o'clock. It's Ridgewood, New Jersey at the Ridgewood Library. It's not a particular U.S. Veg Week. I'm not sure if this was organized part of U.S. Veg Week. But I'm often around at different events, anything pretty much in D.C. That's related to vegan or vegetarianism, I'm there. I do a lot of work with a lot of local organizations. But I can't think of anything else just this week. But if you'd like to put my information online, I'm happy to share, you know, some of the things that I'm doing if anyone's interested in getting involved.
Okay, super. That's great. So the movie is called Vegucated. Is that what you said?
Yes, it's Vegucated.
That sounds very, I love
very,
the title.
Yes, it's very good. It's a really good case study. It's three regular people, meat eaters, that took a 6-week pledge, you know, much like Veg Week was a pledge, and it just takes you through their journey. It's very powerful, very insightful, wonderful documentary. I encourage everyone to check it out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe you could send me the information and I could post it, and maybe I could have the director, maybe some of the subjects on the show to continue this conversation.
Oh, I think she would love that. Yeah, I'm happy to share that with you.
Okay, great. Well, I certainly hope that we can have both of you, Crystal and Christy, on again to talk about, you know, throughout the year sort of, you know, what's going on with regards to you know, Veg Week, U.S. Veg Week, as well as Oakland Veg and the Meatless Monday initiatives, and sort of, you know, sort of what's going on with regards to policies and studies and the reach that this this particular movement has entered. You know, we're talking, you know, about, you know, sort of populations that are limited in their access because they are in custody of some sort, or people that, because of their income and where they live, don't have access to certain types of nutrition. So I would love to continue this conversation, you know, at another date, maybe this summer, you know, when people need to be drinking water, and, you know, water is becoming a scarce resource, and how, you know, you know, certain foods have more water in them than others, and, you know, maybe we could talk about, you know, sort of how people can have better nutrition during the summer months and things like that, and,
absolutely,
you know, yeah.
We would love that. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you both for joining us, and congratulations on this wonderful, you know, Vegetarian Week, you know, nationally and locally. I'm so happy, you know, to be in Oakland, you know, when we're having, you know, one of, I don't know how many cities are participating, but locally, I think, I don't know if San Francisco is doing this because no one from San Francisco has mentioned anything. So, I don't know, is Oakland the hub for U.S. Veg Week here in the Bay Area?
Oakland is representing, yes. I don't know of any other events that are happening in the greater Bay Area, but this is an awesome community for people who are interested in food advocacy, and so we're excited, I think, to be the star of the Bay Area.
All right, cool. Well, you all have a great rest of the day, and thank you so much for joining us.
You as well.
Thank you so much, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Goodbye.
Bye. So we're going to close the show with another piece from Howard Wiley's The Angola Project, We played Amazing Grace, didn't quite get through all of that. And Amazing Grace was the name of was the name of a slave ship. It's actually, you know, the song has become somewhat of an anthem, but yeah, but it was actually has a more torrid type of history, and so it's really fitting that that Howard Wiley would have it on his Angola Project CD. So I'm thinking about actually playing the entire Amazing Grace because it's just so beautiful. And you might want to look it up, the Angola Project, and read about Amazing Grace, you know, so the history of that song. And but I think I'm going to play the rest of it just because it's so beautiful, and so the language of it is just really, really moving. Or I could play the rest of, actually, No More My Lord. I'm not certain. Or I could play Rise and Fly, second line. Trying to think. You know what else? I think I was actually going to play the piece. I'm going to play two pieces. I'm going to start with this piece by Fela Kuti on water. And then I'm going to end with one of the Angola pieces. I'm going to play Water No Get In Me. And then I'm going to shift to the Angola Project. So thank you so much for tuning in for the Wednesday edition of Wanda's Picks. And looking forward to hearing having you join us on Friday at 8 o'clock Pacific time for another edition of Wanda's Picks. Be well.
So, you decided to stay for the second set. One, two, three, four. In Nigeria, we have a saying. Water, no get any me. Uh-huh. As a boy, it is one of those things my mother used to tell me that meant nothing and everything. So I made it into a lovely song. Yeah, yeah.
If you want cook soup, water you must use.
Sorry, bang bona, me like a roe.
If your head is hot, water cool you down.
Tomo bang daka, me lo malu.
For your child to grow, water him go use.
Tomi papa mario, me na lo malu. Nothing without water.
Cause I'm too late, come on, love me, oh, 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 oh,
oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh,
oh,
oh, oh,
oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh,
oh, oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh,
oh, oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh,
oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh, oh,
you will fight for my life, you will wonder.
You will fight for my life, you will wonder.
As they talk of black power,
as they talk of black power.
sisterhood was in when style bomb. None by vops in dingwin dubu hood was you feel gum. Bit speevin vidu oot wizard fazil fencing boffin e again when gibbet when wizard and vindim lovam. So vindu wang fit swin vindibu oot win zoo fin vidibi hood one swank man win lal gilgin dial. Ivan Van Duby Hot Swin Van Duby Hood Wiz Up Argyle Fun Van Mile Gandilgar Thought Fin Swin Van Duby Hoodies and Win Uber Rin Van Tha Fin swing through the horseshoe in swing van de monkailga so van de manskap even out fin sing van de wolf a lap fin sing van de boot wins your boot wins him van zot so van zervi hen win monkailga bum num fun van de wong win vatsur hoof is zot swin van de rule the hat we zip in to the hoop and left fin deal gin up wall ear gun swift swing van de heath and scandal gop Love fin fin de woven lead again fin fin de woven hoobie zum spin fin de woven sa spin fin de woven la met fin thing uber wolf fin thing fin de woven vin swing van dim ga numsy spin fin fin de go I'll ga met fin fin de woven fin de woven swing fin de woven zum Ivan fin de woven zum while fin de my guy fum Ivan do win the Lil Guy Ha Fa Moon Fin Fin Deal Genzo
Oh.